Not work. Yeah. Welcome, everybody. Well, it's the first talk after the keynote speaker, Rob, from earlier. Now we've got another Rob. Well, like Ken Robinson is saying, school kills creativity. And this Rob has found a solution for it, restoring the creativity. And it's called Robot to Robot. From Robot to Robot. Rob, the floor is yours.
Hi. Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Is that wave at the back? You can hear me. Excellent. Thank you. Hi. I'm Rob. I'm a PhD student at the University of Southampton at the moment. But in my other spare time, I work on this project called Student Robotics. And I'm going to tell you about that today. But first, I'm going to take a bit of a short detour, really to sort of justify why this kind of project is important and why I think everyone here should be thinking about getting involved in projects like this. This detour is going to involve banks somewhat weirdly. So probably everyone here is familiar with that film, hopefully. But you're probably more familiar with the term hacker and what it means. But you're probably more familiar with what it means to you and probably what it means to the media. But I've become very aware that this term means different things to different people. The hacker term has been around since sort of the 60s at least. There are various groups of people which you can associate the word hacker with, but they all have very different views and ideas. I mean, CCC probably has quite different views to the Homebrew Computer Club. Just looking at who came out of that, and so on. And there are loads of hacker groups around the world, you know, hacker spaces and things. But this term really means different things to different people, as I say. And to me, it means something. I think we can take all of the definitions that we see, and it really means just someone who is creative with the things around them. And that's what I'm going to use it for in this talk, just really to mean someone who is creative. But it's still kind of distinct from hobbyist and amateur in certain ways. They kind of convey that the individual doing something isn't necessarily doing it particularly well, but hacker sort of has a different vibe to it, and it has a element of community and culture and things like that. But I think, looking at this room, we're definitely, in that really small piece of this highly accurate pie chart. If you think about that pie chart as the world's population, this is grossly exaggerated as the number of hackers in our community and population. And I see this as a problem, really, because it means that we aren't always thought of when we're trying to do things and trying to work with other people. People don't really see why hacking something is good. And just think about that a bit more. Why would we want more hackers in our society? I'm sure a lot of you can answer this question, but I think one of the big problems that it solves is that creative people are good at solving problems. That's something that they do. But creative people are also good at creating problems you didn't even know you had, and that's something quite important, really. If someone solves a problem that you didn't actually realize you had, but you realize later that you did have it, then you've won quite a lot without having to do much. Which brings me to banks. As you know, banks are these fountains of paperwork that and bureaucracy, and they store our money for us. But most people think of a bank as a place in the street, and increasingly a website. And I'm talking about most people, as in the rest of the population that isn't us. They just put their money in, they'll look at the interest rate and so on, maybe, and they'll spend their money and rack up debt and credit, whatever. And they don't really see it as more than that. They kind of see the bank as a static thing. It's got all the features they need. They don't realize that it could do more, or they could do more with it. So I'm quite interested in my bank having an API so that I can work with it in a creative manner. And I think lots of you will know what an API is, an application programming interface. But just to be clear, I mean a bank API here is something where I have my bank and I can communicate with it from a bit of software or something, probably over the internet or some network, and do stuff with my bank. All the things that I could do when I'm standing in my bank and more, you know, get events and stuff when things happen. And one of the big problems that I have when I'm trying to convey this to, you know, people who aren't in this room, is that they don't understand. Why would your bank want to have this thing? Why would you want to interact with your bank using this API? And so normally I kind of go, well, you know, it might make doing my finances a bit better, or I could find out my bank balance much more quickly. And they go, well, that sounds kind of good, but I don't really need that, and we don't need this. And to them, it's just, you know, ATM in the street, and that's it. It's very difficult. Like, well, I found it very difficult before to try and convince someone that they really wanted their bank to have an API. I mean, for example, my mum doesn't think she needs her bank to have an API, but that's because she probably wouldn't use it directly. She wouldn't use it in a program that she's written or something like that. And so until a few weeks ago, this sort of argument kind of just stopped there, really. But then I came across and these sets of wallets, which you might have seen, which are called, they're made by a guy in MIT. They're called the proverbial wallet. And this one gets harder to open the less money you have in your bank account. So it gives you the kind of idea is that it gives you a sort of tangible physical interface to your what's now more of an electronic situation. And he's got a couple of other ones as well. This one just vibrates when there's an electronic transaction that happens in your bank account. So, you know, you might develop a sense for when some dodgy stuff is happening with your money or something like that, just to give you more of an idea of when you're spending. And I think this one is the weirdest one. This one inflates the more money you have in your bank account to attract potential mates. Yeah, but to make these things, you really need to be able to interact with your bank in an electronic form, unless the bank has sold you that wallet, and they've approved it. You know, you have to type in, get your little calculator device, plug it into your wallet every time you want to know what bank balance you've got. Then you're not going to be able to buy that wallet if there's no API, or unless John Kessner gets some sort of agreement with a bank, you know, and that's going to involve a lot of paperwork, and that's probably going to stop him from doing it, from actually making these anymore. My guess is that he screen scraped the bank website to actually get this data out, which isn't a sort of sustainable approach to getting an API from something. But I think that this really kind of shows that there are things that you can do with things that don't initially look like there's a space of creativity on top of them. And the people who are providing a service who say, no, we're not going to provide you with an API, we're not going to allow you to do these things, they're in their sort of box, and it's either that they can't see that how you could be creative with these things, and the other thing is that, and this is probably quite likely with the bank, they don't have enough customers asking them for an API, because they're a business and that's what they want. They want their customers to have something. So how do we solve that problem? How do we make it so that more of their customers and other businesses have an API? So the general point is that there are bits of technology which we find uses for which the manufacturer didn't, and we want shops and things to have APIs, and like I might want my plumber to have an API. Most of the interactions I have with a plumber, they're pretty regular. They're kind of, I want you to fix that tap, I want you to fix that shower and stuff. So we might be able to sort of abstract that into an API, but that's not really something that the general population is really thinking about. And so we need to think about how we can get more hackers into our society, or at least people, more awareness of hackers in our society, how we can get people to be aware that systems can be hackable, as in you can create on top of systems that are already there. And even if they need to be aware that even if they can't see a way of hacking this thing, someone else probably can. There are a lot of people in the world, and they can think of a lot of things. So, what are the reasons that we have only a really small number of hackers today? Why? So I think one of the major reasons is resources, access to tools, and things like that. I think a lot of us wouldn't build a lot of the things today that we build today if we didn't have a particular tool. To a man with a hammer, everything's a nail, that kind of thing. And these projects, like RepRap, MakerBot, and Arduino, and things like that, make it easier for and cheaper. That's the essential thing here. Cheaper for people to actually get hold of resources that they can use to become creative with. And that's all well and good. And these projects are doing good work in that area. And there are loads of other projects around and things. And it's pretty much solved in software with free software. That's done. It's really beyond the software and the hardware that we have to think now, I think. And I think that we have to look in education. If you think about it, when did you become a hacker? If you think you're a hacker. And my bet is that it was after you left school. Maybe when you were at university, you started to think you were sort of a hacker, maybe, or become creative at least. And I think that this really shows that the education system itself is not doing enough to make people creative, well, help people maintain their creativity, as Ken Robinson talks about in his books. This quote really kind of sums up his ideas about, or his sort of beliefs about the education and things. And it seems to me that today, as I wrote in the abstract for this talk, the hackers are generally the people who manage to kind of struggle through the education system, holding on to their creativity as tight as they can, and then they get out the other end and go, you know, now I'm a hacker, yeah, that kind of thing. Okay, that's good. Right, we've got the problem. How are we going to solve it? So, when I was 17, I went to college in Cambridge with a couple of the guys down here. And there was a robotics group at my college. And there aren't many of those in the UK at that sort of age. And that was really, really quite an interesting thing. And this robotics group entered this thing called FIRST in the US, which is a robotics competition. And you know, we flew a long way to New York to play this game with a robot that we built. A robot that we built in 6 weeks. A robot that we built in 6 weeks during our exams. Enough said. And first give you 6 weeks to build your robot. And it just so happens that their 6 weeks overlap with the A-level exams in the UK. And that's really a problem, okay? And that costs quite a lot of money. There were probably about 20 of us in total who went across to New York. And taking 20 people to New York and back and putting them in a hotel and feeding them and so on and so on and so on costs quite a lot of money. And that was we had to raise that, you know, through the sort of standard student raising mechanisms, like, you know, parents and sort of random things, you know, like barbecues or whatever. And so that was difficult. And to make it even more challenging, FIRST has a $6,000 entry fee, which isn't small. But in the US, things are quite different there, it seems, because they get a lot of corporate sponsorship and stuff like that. They've got like 2,000 teams or something, which is remarkable. It is an amazing competition. But after all that, we went over there with our crappy robot. It wasn't so crappy when we left. It had this massive sort of forklift arrangement on the front of it, but we had to take it off because it was too heavy. But despite all of these problems, the group of us who went had an amazing time. The whole event was like a sporting event, an American sporting event, so it was massively hyped and so on. There are cheerleaders at a robotics event. And this was something, you know, I'm from the UK. This isn't the sort of thing you normally see. It's very strange, but also excellent. And this really changed my ideas about what I wanted to do in my future. I was going to do a maths degree, and I did an electronic engineering degree, and I think that is pretty much as a result of doing this competition. Jeff and Justin here and I went to Southampton Uni together, and the text in black, you can't read it. And we took we did the same kind of thing with a group of 17-year-olds and took them to Toronto in Canada, and that's Canada, by the way, flew a similar number of miles with them and had to do the same sort of fundraising experience and things. And that probably cost something like £25,000, something like that for a group of 20 people, something of that magnitude. And that's quite a lot of money to have to raise for a single event that's going to last 6 weeks, that's over your exams. So that was kind of okay. But start to think, can we do better? Can we solve this in some way? And I think the answer is yes. So we decided that we were going to have our own robotics competition here, and it was going to have to be cheap, and the robots would have to be autonomous. In first, they're just remote control, and we'd need more time for building robots so that it was less vulnerable to sort of random events in the education regime. And it was at this point that Steve here got involved, and Steve and I really sort of started the group up with Howard Buck, who's not here, unfortunately, and got this group going at the University of Southampton again. And what we knew was that we need some kind of source of money, and that was seemed like a big problem. But then Steve got involved and talked to some people in a nice way, and then the Motorola Foundation sort of came up to us almost out of the blue, I think, and they said, "Hi, we'd like to fund something that's a bit like FIRST in the UK." Yes, excellent. Okay, please give us your money. So they got involved. And over the last few years, we've developed a couple more sponsors. Obviously, the University of Southampton was kind of giving us resources and things, but they've also funded a couple of internships now and things like that. And Bitbox have given us some sort of free hardware assembly and things like that. And just in case I say sixth formers beyond this point, they're 16 to 18-year-olds. I'm not sure if they're entirely unique to the UK, but it just means students in education who are between 16 and 18 years old, really. Okay, so this is some of our group, probably most of it, minus a couple of people. And these people, plus or minus two, are all university students, be it PhD students or undergrad students. And this entire project is run by students. And we ran our competition in 2008. That was quite good, and we've run them every year since then. So we're 4 years in now, and we have 18 teams, which are made up of 151 sixth formers, and we do all of this for less than the amount of money it costs to take one team to New York for a single week. And I think we do something that's much more interesting as well, because our robots are autonomous. So now, today, we have... can I wander around? No. We have a... that's Southampton down there. That's where we're sort of primarily based and started. We've now got teams from London, from Cambridge. There's a team from near Leeds. And we've got a branch starting up at Bristol University, and this is really big for us. This means that we're getting more university students who are the people who are actually volunteering to do work and run this thing involved, and we're really looking to expand to other universities. And as people are leaving university, some of them are staying involved and in contact and things like that. So we're growing, and if you'd like to get involved with helping us grow, that would be awesome. And the other interesting thing about this year is that we've got a team from Grenoble in France. And so we're sort of kind of growing into some other countries as well, very slowly at the moment. Okay, so enough stuff about, why and what we are. I'm going to tell you about the games that the robots play. So at the beginning of the academic year in sort of September time, we set the students a task, and that task so far has always been played in a 8x8 meter arena. That's that big black square. And this year, our game is called Tin Can Rally. We have another shorter wall on the inside to make this track around the outside. Four robots play at once. Again, they're all autonomous robots. There's no remote control. Essentially, you press start on them, and then the game plays for 3 minutes, and no one can interfere with them unless, you know, one's eating a person or something like that. Around the arena in that track, we've got a load of baked bean tins painted red. Why they're red will come apparent in a minute. And the idea is that the robots can pick those up and carry them around. And every time the robot passes a corner of the arena, it gets a point. Every time it passes a corner whilst carrying a baked bean tin, it gets an extra point. So the more baked bean tins it's carrying, the more points it gets. The faster it goes round, the more points it gets. The more corners it passes, the more points it gets. And to make things just a little bit more interesting, we have this, this short detour. And on this bird's eye view, it looks like you might want to take that route, but it's actually a ramp. And on top of that ramp is a magic baked bean tin, which doubles your points. So the idea of this game is that you can be really rubbish and still gain some points. You get 1 point if you move. Because the students are actually building their own robot chassis. They're building, they're attaching wheels to motors and things and building the body of the robot as well. So having a robot that moves is an achievement. And we give points for that. But there are also, there are a couple of routes that different strategies you could take with this game, which kind of hopefully makes it a bit more interesting. Ah, yes, and there's a little black line on the ground which tells you, which you can use to determine when you're coming up to the ramp. So, we give teams hardware in the form of an electronic kit that we've designed. We give them software, which we've also, we've taken from free software sources, and we've written our own as well, and mixed those together. And most importantly, though, we give the teams guidance. We call it mentoring. And if you think back to when you were 17, or try and think forwards to when you're 17, approaching a project which is 6 months long and is kind of quite nebulous and open is quite a scary thing. It's quite difficult. But also, it's a project in which you're asked to be creative with something that's not necessarily something you thought you could be creative with. And so you're probably a little bit scared of that as well. So a lot of our teams get a university student going to them every week to sort of give them guidance. And generally it sort of turns into, them being kicked into actually doing things and stuff like that. But the guidance is really important, making sure that all of the teams actually know what's going on and kind of have an idea of where they're going. That's probably the most important thing. It's more important than the hardware, it's more important than the software. Giving the teams guidance and making sure that they know what they're doing is really important. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about our kit now. So we kind of, in general, had two versions of kit. The one that we first shipped and sort of kind of shipped in various modified forms for the last 3 years ran on these things, which many of you might have seen, the NSLU2 Linksys boxes. And they just have an ARM chip in, quite a slow one. They don't have much RAM, something like 16 meg or something. And this is what all the students' code is running on. And then we gave them this other hardware that we designed that plugs into that. I won't go into what those are because I'm going into what this new kit is in a minute. But we kind of gave that to them. By the way, if you're working with people, never give them electronics that isn't in a case. That is just a recipe for disaster, especially you know, one-off electronics that is quite difficult to get manufactured again, and when the people repairing it are volunteers. So, yeah, and even though we had a lot of, you know, we have standard engineering problems with our kits and stuff, the teams really still managed to build things with it that are quite cool. And this is by far our favourite robot, even though it was actually quite poor at doing the challenge. The challenge in last year was to pick up the red cubes. The blue ones gave you negative points, and the red ones gave you positive points. And the idea was to just get them in your robot by the end of the game. And so this robot has two pincers on front of it, and it tries to grab the token, lift it over its head, and let go of it so it drops into the bucket behind it, with extremely varied success. And hopefully, I've got a very, very short video which might work. We'll see. And I don't know if you can see that, but this robot is entirely autonomous. So what it's doing is, and unfortunately I don't have a video of the best bits where, you know, like it just manages to get the red block, lift it up, let's go, but then it falls forwards. And the whole crowd in the room, even though they were on other teams and stuff, were fully behind this robot. And they were trying to get it to just will it to get this red block behind it. But try as it might, I think it got a few. It was in the final.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. and yeah, so even though we've so with our kit we could build things that worked, and but kit two, which we're in the process of shipping now, is based on the BeagleBoard, which some of you might have heard of, which is a open hardware project run by TI, which has got a ARM A8 in it, which is the same processor as in N900s, and it's pretty good. You know, it's got quite a lot of RAM, it's got quite a lot of flash, it's got USB, and crucially for us, it's got video out, and it's reasonably cheap. So a lot of you will be familiar with this device, which is PSP. This year is the first year that we're giving the students a display in the kit, and that's the one from the PSP. And we've got this nice shiny we call it the power board. It's really sort of the motherboard of the robot. And it's got the display from the PSP in it, connected to the BeagleBoard, which is on the underside, and it sort of does battery management and stuff for the robot. And you can play Doom on it, which is by far the most important use of it. We've got other things, other bits of the kit, so that, you know, you can interface with the real world. You've got a motor controller, there's a joint I/O board for, you know, digital input and outputs, analog input, things like that, and a currently in prototyping board for controlling servos and things. But most of the sensory input from these robots comes from a webcam. That robot you saw just now knew where the red block was because it could see it. And that's something that our volunteers / uni students have done some work on to make sure that we have a vision system that's kind of simple enough to use for someone who's never programmed before to be able to find a red blob in a big white space. And they do their programming in Python, although we're kind of looking to see if we can give them more options in that space. And they, at the moment, they do programming with a USB key. They go between machines with a USB key. They plug the USB key into their PC, into a web-based app, And they click export, put it on the USB key, stick it in their robot, and it runs. And crucially, the students have access to all of the designs of all of the kit that we give them for free. We give them the kit for free, and we give them the designs for free, and we give them all of our guidance for free. And we use, you know, we use JIDA, which is a open source toolchain for doing electronics design. And we've got various other interesting bits of stuff to do with managing API-less distributors of electronic components. And that's a project that we're probably going to work on a bit more and hopefully bottle up into a more friendly form for people outside our project to use. And we use QCAD for sort of 2D CAD type things. If you're interested, you can get all of our source at git.srobo.org. We have quite a few, because we're sort of a bunch of hackers, we're doing things that aren't necessarily completely applicable to teams right now. The BeagleBoard's got a DSP in it, but it lacks a free compiler. And my good friend Jeremy Morse has done quite a lot of work in the last year to write a backend for LLVM, which is a compiler framework, to get to extend it for this DSP, which is quite interesting. In approximately 3 months, he wrote this backend and extended bin utils and so on to do this on his own in his spare time whilst doing a degree. I think TI have just kind of started funding a group of people to extend GCC to do a similar thing, and I don't know if they've got there yet. They're being paid. We used to have meetings as a group, but these were really dull and boring. We got rid of them. Don't have meetings. We replaced them with something we call doings, in which we do things rather than talk about doing things. And it's essentially, we have a room in the University of Southampton where, which is essentially kind of like a hackerspace for 6 hours of the week. It's, instead of being open 24/7, it's open 6/1. And I recommend doing that. So just to wrap up, I think the thing that I kind of see is there's this massive step change that we present people with in reality. They go from school to the real world suddenly like that, and that doesn't really help anyone. I think that we really need to push engineering to younger people, and I think that you guys can help do that. If you want to get involved with anything, be it the hardware, the software, or running a team, please come and have a chat with me. These are some of the people who have been involved. There's more people than I could fit on the slide, so I'm sorry if I haven't got your name there. And thanks for listening. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Rob. Are there any questions? Please raise your hand, and we'll make sure a microphone is coming your way. Over there.
Hey, that was awesome, especially when you talk about education and Ken Robinson and kind of Lincoln, the whole thing. Actually, when I was in college, I hated it, really, because it was a lot of learning and computer science and stuff, and I always used to hate it. And right now I'm involved with a hackerspace in Ireland, and it's amazing. But what's the biggest challenge you face in kind of growing up the community and getting students involved? Like, how did you pitch it for universities, for sponsors, for...
Yeah, that's an important question. And it's becoming increasingly important as we grow. The thing is targeting it to university students is a different challenge to targeting it to sixth formers, which is a different challenge to targeting it to teachers, which is a different challenge to targeting it to sponsors as well. And being a voluntary group who mainly, most of us want to spend our time working on software and hardware and hacking, but we still have to what I'm beginning to realize is that I have to spend more of my time working on sort of encouraging people to get involved in our group through various means. And at the university, we've tried various approaches. Like, we give some talks at the university about things that we use, like tools, like it's turning into an annual talk about using sort of Git, the version control system, and we have a few other talks, hopefully, around that kind of thing. And that makes just great, generally raises awareness about us. I think that's probably the best thing that we can do, is just gradually raise awareness and do the occasional sort of PR stunt. Does that answer your question?
Yes, any other questions? Yes, over there.
Hi, I'm teaching robotics at the Technical High School in Vienna, and I absolutely agree that this is a very nice way to get pupils in touch with hacking technology. But what I'd like to tell you was, have you known that there is a whole conference just about robotics in education? You should present your project there.
Which one?
it was this year in Bratislava, and next year it is in Vienna. It's called Robotics in Education 2011.
No, I wasn't aware of that. I have to go.
Yeah, and I can give you the URL afterwards. And
awesome. Please do.
You should really present it there, because it's such a wonderful project.
Thank you.
Any more questions over there?
Hello. Just a question. Here you just tell how you want to raise the interest or the creativity of the people. How do you get the people to join the project? I had the expression that most people are bored by technique. I'm working at a technical university, and I know this strange, but...
I think it's a chicken and egg problem, because we have people growing up in education, who aren't really aware of technology or of the things that you can do with technology. They're only at a consumer level. They kind of know what they can do, but they don't know how to hack. And we really want to recruit hackers, and that means that we have to create the hackers that we want to recruit. And yeah, it's cyclical, and we just kind of have to hack away gradually, I think, until we get to a point where maybe, hopefully, we don't have to do it as much. Or at least we're doing it to a sufficient degree that there are those people around and interest in technology and hacking.
Sorry, I wasn't clear enough. So how where do you find the people? How do you talk to them? Hey, come to us and join us. And how do you address the people that are not very interested at that time?
The university students or the sixth formers?
Everyone.
With the sixth formers, it's generally through their teachers and through their schools. By building up relationships with the schools, we find, you kind of have to look at each school kind of individually, and because they each have their own way of going about things. Some find it easiest to, like, they have registers and things like that, and just putting a flyer in each of the registers kind of gets people to know about it a bit, and some people will join just from that, but then people will join through their friends, and that's actually how I joined the robotics group at the college I went to. I didn't want to join it at first, and then my friends nagged me until I did. I think, friends is a good one. At university, it's pretty much the same. It's raising awareness. And at the moment in the university, we kind of find the people who have already got most of the skills that we need, which is difficult considering they've just come through, they've basically just come out of the education that we, you know, our target audience of competitors. It's difficult.
It will be. The last question. Yes, over here. I'll come to you.
Hi, I'm Toby. Thank you for what you're doing. I really respect that. Nevertheless, I want to ask whether you discuss the probably consequences of the doing that people do. So robotics and technology can be misused. And I like that you teach young people to use technology, but to what respect are you discussing consequences that could occur?
Okay, so we with the sixth formers themselves, we work really at quite a, they get quite a high level. Most of them get a very high level interface to the hardware because they've never programmed before, and they've never done any electronics. They've never used a saw, this kind of thing, and I think that they have to learn the basics first, or at least learn some of the basics before we can start talking to them about that kind of thing. We don't really do much about that at the moment, but if you can think of a way of conveying that to them, I'm all ears. That'd be great.
Hey, well, thank you very much, Rob. Give it up.